Welcome, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class for March 2013. Our guest is Kelly James Enger, who's going to be talking about writing articles for and using that as a way to earn money. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest. This is her, I think, third time on the call, which is great. Kelly James Enger has written for more than 60 national magazines, including Redbook, Health, Parents, and Runner's World, and has taught magazine writing and freelancing classes for more than a decade. Her books include Dollars and Deadlines, Make Money Writing Articles for Print and Online Markets, and Six Figure Freelancing, The Writer's Guide to Make More Money, Second Edition. Welcome, Kelly.
I'm very happy to be here, Rochelle. Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad to have you. I think everybody's been very excited about this, including me, because I think we all want to make a little bit more money to support our lives. So let's dig right in. I want to again remind people that if you're somewhere where it's going to be loud, go ahead and push star 6 to mute yourself. That way we'll be able to hear Kelly now and at when you listen to the recording. So Kelly, we're all busy. I'm curious to hear you talk about why writers should consider adding nonfiction articles to their repertoire, especially someone who's maybe more of a fiction writer.
It's funny because I've spoken at dozens of writers' conferences, and I've had a lot of people who are not magazine writers or not magazine freelancers come to sessions, and then afterwards they'll come up and say something like, you know, I'm working on a novel. I never thought about writing articles, but now I'm thinking maybe I could do it. Or I've got a book project that I really want to write, but maybe I could do articles too. And I think there's a number of reasons. But first of all, the money is I would start with, because when I quit my job as a lawyer 16 years ago, I wanted to make enough and needed to make enough that I could freelance full-time and not have to go back to the law. And arguably, articles have the are the easiest to break into as a new writer if you or a new nonfiction writer if you don't have any clips or published work to your name. The bars aren't that high. Now, I'm not saying you can write for Smithsonian or Outside with your first query. That's unrealistic. But it's much easier to get started writing articles than, say, to publish a book or to get started in copywriting or writing for businesses. It's just the barriers to entry are lower.
Hmm.
That's important. Secondly, there's the monetary factor, and even if you start out writing for markets that only pay, you know, 10 cents, 20 cents, 25 cents a word, that's a lot better than nothing. And if you're trying to make an income as a writer or you want to make money from your words, which, of course, I'm all about, I think that's important. Third, writing articles gives you experience, and it gives you experience coming up with ideas, working with an editor, researching, interviewing sources, doing all these kinds of things that can inform your other work, whatever that may be. So I've written about topics that I've wound up including in novels or written essays about or you know, my kind of work of the heart, but I've been paid for it too. And then finally, I think a really important thing is for people who are listening that have a book project or maybe more than one book that they want to write, when they go to publish it, they're going to need what's called a platform. And platform is your ability to reach a certain audience, i.e. the readers of your book. And actually, it's the buyers of your book. That's what platform is. So I remember talking to another writer several years ago, and she's a copywriter, you know, and she's a business writer. And I noticed that in her email signature, she blogs about classical music. And I went to her blog, and it looked awesome. And it's, you know, like really nice and really detailed. And I was speaking to her, and I'm like, why do you blog about classical music? I just didn't get it. She kind of laughed. She said, I'm writing a novel, and the main character is a pianist. Oh, well, that's what she's doing. She's creating a platform, meaning the people who follow her blog will likely, hopefully, buy her book when it comes out. Articles do the same thing. And maybe you're writing about the same thing your book is going to be about, but regardless, the more your name is out there, the more markets you write for, the more visible you are, it helps you sell a book to a traditional publisher, and it helps you, even if you go self-publish your ebook or whatever, it helps you sell books to readers. I mean, you've got, you know, if nobody knows who you are, how are they going to find your book? How are they going to know about your book? So I think those are four really good reasons, and I know I blogged for you is that there's the immediacy too. When you're working on a book project, you don't get any feedback for months and months and months, maybe even longer. When you write an article, typically a turnaround time is maybe 2, 4, 6 weeks. You're going to hear back from your editor if she's happy or not. And it's a way to become a better writer. Just, you know, and I like that even though I write primarily books now, I still do articles because I like the fast checks and I like kind of the quick hit. I like finishing something. You work on a book. Not gonna. Well, if you read your book, Rochelle, you'll finish the book in a month. But for most of us, it's gonna take like 6 to 9 months, or maybe a year or longer. So, anyway,
yeah.
So those are reasons why I would consider it.
I think that's great. So tell me, how does someone sell their first article? What's your advice for someone who's just starting out?
It's really two part. The first part is write, pitch something that you are what I call uniquely qualified. Right, meaning some subject that you've got some kind of personal knowledge of or some kind of background or whatever it is. And I think a common mistake that new writers make is that they think, you know, they'll pitch an idea like how to lose weight for the holidays or get your kids ready for school or how to have a great trip to Paris or whatever. But they're not necessarily pitching a piece that they have some kind of personalized, specialized knowledge of. So, for example, if you had lived in Paris for 5 years and you were going to pitch an article on, you know, how to get the best deals in Paris, well, that might be like the great, perfect article for you to write. On the other hand, if you're just writing it because you've gone to Paris one time, I don't know that you're really uniquely qualified. I'm sorry, Rochelle, you're going to hear my printer in a second. I'm just printing out the code in case we get disconnected. I have to call back.
Okay.
But I mean, so number one is coming up with an idea that you're uniquely qualified to write. So, for example, my first sale was to Cosmo, and it was on how to survive your last 2 weeks on the job. Well, at the time, I'd quit my job because I hated being a lawyer. I quit jobs 4 times in 5 years, so I had a pretty good personal experience with the last 2 weeks on the job. That made me uniquely qualified. But the second part of that test, which new writers don't think. They're like, okay, I'm going to write about something I know about. Okay, done, easy. Is find a market where readers will be interested in that idea. So I sold that article to Cosmo. Think about the typical readers of Cosmo. You know, they're women in their probably late teens, 20s, mid-30s. They pretty much all of them work. I would say the majority of them have careers as opposed to jobs where you would give a two-week notice. You know, if you work at McDonald's, you probably don't give a two-week notice. You just don't show up for work. But point being that the topic was one that I had personal experience with, number one. Number two, it was a topic that was going to interest the readers of the market I was pitching. So that's part of it. So I think that two-part test, and we'll talk a little bit more about markets in a minute, but I think that's what you do. You come up with an idea that you've got something unique to offer, and then you find a market that the readers of that publication, whether it's print or online, it's a website, a blog, I don't care, but something that those readers will be interested in. You know, you really want it to pass that two-part test.
Oh, that's really helpful. Thank you. Well, I'm curious, you know, what markets should new writers focus on? Maybe not the Smithsonian Magazine. Maybe not some of those upscale markets. What are good markets for first-time writers?
Well, and you know, I get asked this all the time, both in email and on my blog. There isn't some group of markets where it's like, here's where all the new writers start out. You know what I mean? It's not like,
okay,
this, you know, I wish I could say that there were. I wouldn't say that the bigger the market, the more the market pays, the more competitive it is. So if you're talking about pitching O, good luck. I mean, it's a Reader's Digest, good luck. It's markets, because you have to think about it. They pay very well. They have a limited number of freelancers they can use. They're probably going to have, you're going to have writers who have a lot of experience at the top of their game pitching those markets. At the same time, that doesn't mean you can't pitch them as a new writer, but what I suggest is that writers look for markets that they can write for more than once. And the reason is it takes an incredible amount of time to look at a market, study it, get an idea for what they want, check out its guidelines, maybe you look at the last couple of issues, or if you're looking at a website, you read 8, 10, 12 articles. But you're not just going to pitch somebody cold. You want to know about that market. And it's much easier to write for the same market more than once than it is to write for, you know, I'd rather write for the same market 5 times than write for 5 different markets. It's a lot less marketing time. it's a lot less wear and tear on me, and it's a lot easier to make more money, because the more you write for a market, typically the more you can get paid by that market. So that's I used to take the approach of I would come up with an idea and then look for a market for it. So like I wanted to write about local vegetarian groups, so I had this idea. And then I found Vegetarian Times, and I wrote the piece for Vegetarian Times. But that doesn't really make sense. I should be looking for an idea for a market that I could write for multiple times. So, for example, I wrote for Chicago Parent years ago when my son was, I'm guessing, about two. But I knew that even though I didn't want to write about parenting per se, my first story was on, I think it was on toddler tooth traumas because he fell and he broke his teeth. When he was about two, and coincidentally, I had a toddler tooth trauma. Well, they're actually really common. It's like one in three kids will, you know, have a dental crisis before they're five. So I wrote that piece, but I knew, since I had a two-year-old, that I could come up with lots more ideas. And then eventually that morphed into writing. I really write about the woman who happens to be a mom. Like I write more for the mom or for the woman more than the mom, if that makes sense.
Yep.
But my point is, when I pitch Chicago Parent, no, Chicago Parent doesn't pay as well as Parents or Parenting, both of which I've written for. But when I pitched it, the piece was assigned immediately. There were no rewrites. There was no hassle. It immediately ran. I mean, it was just, it's a lot different process. So coming back to the types of markets, a market that you can write for more than once, and a market that you feel like you get. Like, I can write for Runner's World because I get Runner's World, meaning not just that I read it, but I'm a runner. I've been a runner for a long time, but I know what they cover. I know what angles they take. I know what their articles look like. The more you know, the more you know about your market, the easier it is for you to pitch something that will work for that market.
Mm-hmm.
I do encourage people to consider online publications, because they typically need more material than their print cousins. So like if you have Self and Self.com, Self.com is probably going to upload new content several times a week as opposed to Self, the print magazine that comes out once a month. Think about it. They're going to need more stuff. And there's, even though about 75% of successful freelancers that I've interviewed and you know, talked to and surveyed write for online publications, there are still some people who aren't doing it. I think they think it's, I don't want to say beneath them, but I think they think, well, the rates aren't as high as print. Well, that's true, but I found that online writing, sometimes you can do it more quickly, not as complicated, so you might not make quite as much per word, but if you can crank the work out, you can still make a good living per hour. And then on the print side, local, regional publications, trade publications, any kind of custom magazines, anything that's kind of off the radar, meaning magazines that somebody wouldn't necessarily see in Writer's Market, you know, that they might not be aware of. Those are good places to pitch simply because you're not competing against as many writers. If you have a background in a particular trade or profession or industry, why not pitch, you know, a trade magazine or a publication for an association that you know something about? So I wrote for IGA Grocergram for years. I've never owned a grocery store, but I did work at Trader Joe's for a while when I, you know, just for fun. So I know what an end cap is, and I know what reefer stands for. It's not, you know, it's not pot. It's what you call a refrigerator when you work in a grocery store or work in a restaurant. It's the reefer. So stuff like that, that kind of knowledge can transfer to your writing work as well. So bottom line, a market that you know, a market that you think you can write for more than once, and maybe a market that's under the radar. Those would be my three suggestions.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's go back to this whole question about online and print markets and the difference between the two of them. Can you talk a little bit about the difference and maybe just how to spot like a legitimate? Because I think so many people are writing for free for online markets. It's hard to imagine that anybody's going to pay you.
Uh-huh. Now, see, and I think that's a misconception because
okay. There
are, yes, there are online markets that don't pay. There are some big names that don't pay, but my understanding is, for example, that Huffington Post doesn't pay.
Right.
However, if you get a post up on Huffington Post or you get a story up there, you may get, you know, tens of thousands of hits that may be worth writing for free. It'd be sort of similar to getting something in the New York Times or, you know what I mean? You may
yep.
get so much media attention, it's worth it. But when you're talking about smaller sites that, you know, that's not Salon or doesn't have that cachet, I'm skeptical because When you write for free, you're not only devaluing your own work, you're devaluing all writers' works. Now, again, I write my own blog, and I do that for free, but I'm blogging for a business reason. I have a purpose in doing it. When I'm promoting a book, I might do some things for free, but again, I'm promoting my book, so that's a conscious choice. But coming back to the online thing, a lot of online markets do pay. But I can tell you, if people will do stuff for them for free, they're not going to offer to pay you. I mean, so for example, when you're looking at a website or an online publication, there, you know, look around for writer's guidelines. There, you know, almost all sites have them now. It's much easier than when I, you know, started 16 years ago, and I actually used to write magazines and say, please send me a copy of your writer's guidelines in the self-addressed stamped envelope. Excuse me. So anyway, look at their guidelines. And if their guidelines say, if there's no mention of pay, no, they don't pay. But if you're not sure, then you can send a query and say, if they come back to you and then you find out they don't pay, then you have to consider whether you want to write for that market. But sorry, I'm talking about this too long, and I should just say, ask around. Look for markets that have a print presence. So again, I use the example of self.com pays, parents.com pays. And then also there are a lot of websites, whether it's a standalone website or a blog, and they pay for content too. But again, you have to take the approach when you're coming to them that you expect to be paid. There's what I call content mills that pay, you know, $3, $4, $5 for an article. I'm not talking about that when I talk about selling articles. I don't know anyone who can write an article for $5 and make a living doing it. I think that's ridiculous. And you could spend your time better finding a market maybe that would pay you $50 or $75 for a blog post. I've done blog posts for $75. People might say, well, that's not very much money. Well, I can write them in less than an hour. My three-year-old just came in my office. Hang on one second. Go on. Go see Olivia. Sorry about that. That's how life is.
We
have little kids at home. At least she didn't yell. But anyway, my point is, if I can do a blog post in less than an hour and make $75, I'm fine with that. So I think part of it is realize that there are plenty of markets that pay, and if 75% of experienced freelancers are writing for online publications, I'm telling you there's money in it. Maybe not quite as much money, but the writers I know who do a lot of online work are fast, and they're able to, you know, write quickly and write for a number of markets. I know a lot of writers who have like online blogging gigs where they might blog once or twice a week for certain markets. Once you're doing that, it doesn't take that much time to write the next blog. In some cases, they're not even having to do background research. They're just given a contract where, okay, we want you to write about X. That's, you know, you can churn those out relatively quickly. Another difference, obviously, most online articles tend to be shorter, tend to be a little chunkier. There's interactive elements. Maybe there's a quiz. Maybe there's photos. Maybe there's slideshows are really popular. You know, just think about when you go online, what do you like to read? How do you like to be engaged? If you go to a website, let's say you want to write for a gossip or a celebrity website, and you see that they do a lot of slideshows of, I don't know, like who wore it best or most surprising couples or whatever, as you're pitching to that market, you should be thinking something like along those lines, something that would fit, something that would belong with that market. And then, again, one other difference is that online markets do tend to need more copy than their print counterparts, and that's good news for writers. Rochelle, I feel like I kind of rambled there. Did I answer what you were asking?
You absolutely did. And I have a follow-up question, which I think is going to help our listeners too. And the follow-up question has to do with Elance and sites like that. A lot of the writers I coach talk about starting out with Elance, and I try to say, you know, I'm not sure that's the best way to go because the budgets people set are pretty low. So I'm curious to hear what you think about Elance and other kinds of places like that that farm out writing jobs, if you think that works.
You know what? Here's the thing. I have looked at those sites. Here's my problem. The people who are hiring writers through those sites aren't looking for the best writer. They're not even looking for a good writer. They're looking for the cheapest writer. And you're going to get into, well, you know, I'm willing to do, this actually just happened to a writer I know of. I'm not going to use any names or anything, but she was writing for a particular market for a certain amount of money, and now the market's decided that they want to pay less. So they're using a site similar to Elance. It's not Elance, but something similar to have writers pitch for a lower amount of money. And she and I were talking about that, and I said, well, they're cutting their budget or they want to get it cheaper, so they will. I said, but let me tell you something. When they get it cheaper, that doesn't mean it's going to be better, so I don't necessarily think that market's close to you. They may find out, hey, wait, she's really valuable at what we were paying her before. So you have to think, you know, how valuable am I as a writer? And if you, I mean, again, the stuff I've seen on Elance, if I went in there and said, offered to write a book proposal for, say, $3,500, $4,000, which is typically about what I charge even today, you know, 5 years ago it would have been $7,500 to write a book proposal, there'll be somebody who will come in there and do it for $500. Well, I can't play. I can't bid against that. I can't go that low. It's not worth it. And I choose to spend my time looking for markets that are going to pay at least some kind of reasonable level. Again, I gave the example of the $75 blog post. I'm willing to do that if I can do it in less than an hour. I do look at sites like Craigslist, journalismjobs.com. There are a number of sites that have freelance gigs or new markets listed or whatever. And I have found work through Craigslist. I've actually had a couple of really good ghostwriting projects come through Craigslist, and I've had some magazine work come through it too. But it's one in 100, 200 posts. So my point is I wouldn't spend a lot of time going to a site like Elance where you're going to be bidding against, you know, dozens of other writers. I would be proactive and say, okay, what markets do I want to write for? What markets are a good fit for me? What can I, you know, what do I have to bring to the table instead of, okay, I'm going to go into this, you know, big marketplace and compete against all these people who are willing to do it for next to nothing. It just, you know what I mean? Think about it from a business perspective. It doesn't really make sense.
That's a great way to think about it. Yeah, perfect. Thank you. So let's go back to kind of the writing a query letter. And I think I'm guessing that you write a query for both online sites and print sites. So talk a little bit about why I should write a query rather than writing up a whole article and setting it in.
You know, the question comes up a lot with shorter pieces, what are called FOB or front of book. A lot of websites run short pieces like this, but the term came from print magazines. That if you look at a print magazine, the front of the magazine after you get through the ads has all these like shorter pieces. Maybe there's 3, 4, or 5 pieces on when I say piece, I mean article on a page, 100 words, 200, 300 words, whatever. And they're typically a great place to break in because experienced writers tend to ignore them because they're not that many words. New writers, an editor is willing to give you a chance because if you screw up, you've only screwed up a couple paragraphs. She can fix it or she can find something to fill that hole. And the editors who edit those sections tend to be lower on the totem pole, and they may not have a stable of writers, and maybe they're looking for writers, so that's always a good thing. But anyway, people will say, well, why don't I just write the piece and send it in? And I know different writers have different opinions about this. I know other writers who do this. That's fine. I like to use a query for several reasons. Number one, it shows the editor you get it. I know how this business runs. Writers send query letters. That's how we approach editors. That's how we approach online markets, print markets, blogs, whatever. Now, maybe you're writing for a blog and it says, well, we want you to send the whole blog post. Fine. Follow what the blog says. But I'm saying in general when you're pitching. So it shows the person that I get it. Number two, it gives the editor an idea of what I want to do with the story, how I'm going to approach it, how many words it's going to be, the experts I plan to talk to. And it gives him or her a chance to say yes, you know, follow your query. That happens pretty frequently. Or, I like this idea, but we just covered something similar. Could instead of focusing on the health benefits of having a cat, let's focus on the health benefits of having fish. You know, we want to do something on that. Now, if she comes back to me and says that, I'll say, great. So I'll go do some research on the health benefits of having fish. If I just write the article in or write the article and send it in, she's going to toss it. She's not going to get back in touch with me and say, well, how about this? Because I haven't opened a conversation with her. I've just, you know, send, here's what you need. Well, I can't read her mind, you know. And one of the things I say when I teach magazine writing is when you write an article, you pick a topic and an angle and the number of words and the format, the structure, how many people you're going to talk to, what kind of people are you going to talk to, what tone you're going to take, whether you're going to have sidebars. I mean, think of all of the decisions that go into writing anything, including a 150-word piece. Do you think that you are going to give the editor exactly what she wants in terms of length and structure and format and sources? You're not. It's just impossible. So to me, a query shows that you get the business, makes her an offer that lets her accept it on those terms or on her own terms, and finally just increases your chance of getting an assignment. Because I will tell you that some of my queries that quote-unquote succeeded were not assigned, but the editor liked my query and said, you know, and this is how I got into Bridal Guide, I pitched something on talking about money. It was on how to talk about money. And by the way, the lead for the query was featured an anecdote about a woman named Kathleen, that's my middle name, who was upset when her husband-to-be came home with a $40,000 red truck 3 months before their wedding. That really happened. And he couldn't understand why I was upset. Of course, what I saw is this is what we're going to be paying off for the next 5 years, right? So I used that idea, uniquely qualified, and the editor came back and she said, you know, I like this idea, but we just had a story on this. I want to do something on, like, what's your money style? In fact, I have a book sitting here that's great. Would you be interested in writing a piece on what's your money style? And I'd like you to interview the author. I was like, sure. Okay. That was $500, $500, 1,000 words, my first piece for her, and I wrote more than a dozen articles for that same editor there. And it's because I didn't write an article and send it in and pray, you know. And that's just not what we do. That's just not how the business is run. So those are, I think, four good reasons there.
I think that's great. That's very helpful. So I know that you've also talked a little bit in your blog about this whole idea of writing a letter of introduction to editors. And what's that? And how can that be a helpful tool for writers?
I think other than the query letter, your LOI, letter of introduction, is your second most effective weapon. Now, if you have 100,000 followers on Twitter, okay, then Twitter is probably going to be your most effective weapon. But I'm just speaking in generalities. So you've got your query letter, which comes, it gives one idea. Here's why your readers will care. Here's how I'll approach it. Here's why I'm the perfect person to write the story. That's a query letter. A letter of introduction is a little bit different. Instead of selling an idea, you sell yourself. So I will use an LOI when I'm approaching a business or a corporation, an association, a trade magazine, a custom magazine, a publication that either an organization that may be looking for writers or a market that needs writers and already is going to be creating their own editorial calendar. So, for example, with IGA Grocergram, I could pitch them with an idea. Maybe I could pitch them on Green Your Grocery Store, like ways that grocery stores, IGAs, are, you know, becoming, having smaller carbon footprints or whatever, based on something I've seen at my local store or whatever. But just as effective with those kinds of markets is to send an LOI that says, you know, I'm contacting you because I'm interested in writing for your publication. I've written for a number of publications about retailers, blah, blah, blah. I think this is actually a copy. This is in Six Figure Freelancing. I approached Pampered Chef, which is a company based about 25 minutes from my house, about freelancing for them. And the way it came about was I had noticed, because I always used to look at the want ads in the Tribune under writers, and there's hardly any in there. You know what I mean? Like if you want to be in sales or whatever. But I would always look. And it seemed like they always had an ad in there for Pampered Chef was always hiring writers. And I was like, man, that must be the worst place on earth to work. All I could think was, you know, they kept firing people or people kept quitting. Well, what it was is they were rapidly expanding their writing department. Mm. So I didn't want to go work for them full time, but I did want to freelance for them. So the letter said something, it was goofy, but it said something like, you know, Dear Ms. Bokar, picture this. You know, your whole staff is swamped with other projects, and you've got this brochure that needs to go out by Friday, and, you know, blah, you try to set this up. And then wouldn't it be great if you had a writer on call who could come in and handle those kinds of projects for you? Well, I'd like to be that writer, or something like that, as opposed to I am interested in freelancing for the Pampered Chef. I just wanted to mix it up a little. And I sent that letter to a couple dozen companies in the Chicago area. That letter got me a freelancing gig, and a very well-paid freelancing gig. I freelanced for them several times when I was filling in for people on maternity leave. But the idea was, and then I said, I've written, you know, about nutrition and food and fitness, and I've written a wide variety of pieces, including, because, again, this is a company. I don't know what they need. yes, I've written magazine articles. They may or may not care about that. So I played up the fact that I'd written newsletter articles, I'd written sales letters, I'd written ad copy. Now, I'd done all these things. So with an LOI, again, instead of selling one idea, you're selling yourself as a writer and saying, you know, here's what I can research and write about. Here's my skill set. What do you think? And hopefully they'll say, yeah, we need a writer like that. Or, you know, maybe you would, you know, fit for us or whatever. But it's just another tool that you can use to reach out to somebody. And you know, how am I going to write a query for the Pampered Chef? I don't know what they need in terms of, you know, what kinds of ideas they cover. Does that make sense in terms of the difference?
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. Now, when would you use a letter of introduction for a magazine editor or a blog editor?
With blogs, I found that most blogs want you to send the whole blog. You know what I mean?
Okay.
That's been my experience. Very, very. I don't think I've queried a blog. I've just written the post and sent it in. But again, I've had a very good idea of what they're, you know, like I read the guidelines. This is how many words they want. This is what they want you to talk about or not talk. You know, I really try to follow the guidelines. With magazines, though, it would be a trade publication or what's called a custom magazine, where they're probably not going to be looking for ideas the same way consumer magazines are.
Mm.
And I don't really want to have to come up with ideas. I just want to get in the game and say, okay, here I am. Can I write for you? So, for example, I'm a certified personal trainer and group instructor in addition to writing. So if I wanted to write for, there's a number of fitness publications for people in the industry, I could just send a letter of introduction and say, you know, here's my fitness background, but I've also been a freelancer for 16 years. I can cover blah, blah, blah. Even as I say this, this is what I should be doing to continue to grow my business and probably have good results with that. Now, I could also come up with a query, but a letter of introduction is quicker and easier, and once you have a template, it's a way to get your foot in the door pretty quickly. We talked about markets, but I also use them if I'm going to, let's say, approach somebody about a ghostwriting client. Again, I would use an LOI. But for something like, let's say there are people who want to get a speaking gig or a teaching gig, you know what I mean? A strong LOI is always a good tool to have because you can use it for a lot of different things.
That's great advice. I appreciate that. So let's say, you know, we actually do get a query accepted and it comes time that we need to research our article or, you know, do some things to put the article together. How do we go about finding sources? I know you talked about, you know, even presenting the people that you might talk to in your query letter. So how do we start finding those people?
Right. Well, I think, Rochelle, I that's the book I sent you, the Dollars and Deadlines, Make Money Writing Articles for Print and Online Markets. What's different about that book and what I really like about it is I use a dozen of my own actual articles, and I talk about with each one, this is how I researched it, you know, step one, step two, step three, because each article is going to be a little different. But in general, when you pitch an idea, you're going to have done some background research. So let me just do one really small example that I'm featuring on my blog right now, and then I'll broaden it. But I did a story on a new study that had showed that something called non-activity exercise thermogenesis, which is what they call NEAT. And what it is it's fidgeting and moving around in your chair and chewing gum and, you know, doodling, whatever it is. So in a meeting, some people will sit still. Some people will jiggle their leg, cross their legs, uncross their legs, pop their shoe on, pop their shoe off. So people who have high amounts of NEAT, that's what they call this, burn about 500 more calories a day than people who just sit still. That's a huge number, by the way. So it was an interesting study, and in that case, I got a copy. I went to my library. I had found the citation for this study, went to the library and said, again, this is probably 10, 12 years ago, hey, I need to find the study, and they requested it for me. So you could request things through your local library that you wouldn't have access to. You can also use online databases like Electronic Library, and there's other ones where you pay to get a copy of the study. Once I had that study, I've got the names of the researchers, and I contacted the university where the study was and said, I'm writing an article about this study. I need to talk to one of the researchers. Can you set up that interview? So that's how I did that interview for that kind of source. Let's say I'm doing a story on toddler tooth traumas. Well, I'm writing it for Chicago Parent, so who am I going to want to interview? I'm just going to toss it back to you, Rochelle. Who would make sense to interview?
Well, I'd look at the dentist they profiled in their periodicals.
Correct. Right, right. And I actually did ask. I asked my editor. I said, is there any dentist in particular you want me to interview? And she had somebody. Now, not surprisingly, it was somebody who had advertised in the magazine. Oh, that kind of thing happens. But and then there was somebody she didn't want me to interview because he'd been featured in the magazine. So with that in hand, I picked I think I had two or three dentists in that story who were pedodontists who specialize in children. I could use another dentist, but I want somebody who sees kids all day long. That's all he does. And in the Chicago area, Chicago parent. If I had been writing that piece for a national magazine, I probably would have had a dentist from New York, maybe a dentist from Texas, maybe a dentist from California, because for a national magazine, you want your sources to be spread out. You don't want them all three to be in Manhattan. You don't want them all three to be in Los Angeles. And then as far as, let's say I needed to find some real people sources, I'd be on Facebook, like, hey, has anybody had their, you know, two-year-old fall and break his teeth? Or I'd put it on Twitter, or maybe I'd go on LinkedIn. I'd use my social media. And I would also use my friends. For real people sources, I'll send an email to girlfriends, neighbors, whatever, and say, hey, I need to find, you know, a mom of triplets who has gone back to work as a cardiologist, who's, you know, in an interracial marriage, who has three golden retrievers, and someone inevitably will find that person for me. But to go back to the finding those sources, a really good place, of course, there's Google, which makes life easy, but let's go back to the dentist. Let's say I have no clue. I've never written this kind of article before. I don't have any of my own books. I'm like, oh, my gosh, what do I do? Well, there's this organization called the American Dental Association. It's the biggest association of dentists in the country.
I'm afraid we lost Kelly. Kelly, are you still there? I'm sure she's going to dial back in, so I think we'll just kind of hang on the phone and wait for her. If you're here wondering what happened, I'm sure she'll be back in a few minutes. One of the sources that I found really helpful, or one of the resources I found really helpful in looking for article sources is HARO, or Help a Reporter Out. And they're very good at having you. They're very good at getting queries out there typically quickly within a week, and it goes to thousands and thousands of people, and that can be a wonderful tool for getting. Hey, Kelly, is that you?
Yes, I'm sorry. That was my phone. It just dropped. I'm so sorry. I'm on a landline. I don't know what happened, but.
No problem. I was just talking about Help a Reporter Out as being another resource.
Yes, Help a Reporter Out, and then there's another one called ProfNet, which is it's been around a lot longer than HARO.
And what's it called?
It's called ProfNet, ProfNet. Just Google that; it'll come up. It's and one of the nice things about ProfNet, and one of the reasons I actually prefer it to HARO, although I have used both of them, is that ProfNet allows you. They have a database of experts, like tens of thousands of people, and you can just go in there and poke around, and you decide who you contact, as opposed to people getting in touch with you. I like to be, you can tell, I like to be proactive instead of, okay, well, hopefully someone, you know, will come back to me. I really try to go out and look. But my point about the American Dental Association was that whatever you're talking about, whether it's a hobby or a science or a profession or a business or whatever, there's an organization for it. So when you find an organization, you can call their public affairs or media affairs person and say, hey, I'm doing a story on toddler tooth traumas. Can you please suggest a couple of dentists in the Chicago area who treat kids? If they've been interviewed by the media, that's great. Depending on what kind of story you're doing, if you want somebody associated with a hospital, or you want somebody who's a book author, or you want somebody who's well-spoken, because the PR people in an organization, or you could do this with a university or college too, they know who their people are. They know who's done what. It will save you a lot of time while you're like, well, who could be the best pedodontist out there? Because all you're going to do is get on Google and find, you know, thousands of them. So that's a shortcut I use pretty frequently. And again, I'll say, I need somebody who's written at least two books about this, or I need somebody who's associated with a teaching hospital, or I need someone who can, you know, let's say I'm doing a story on stress management, which I write about a lot. I'm going to say, I need somebody who's really got great quotes. I don't want, you know, the same old stuff, you know, exercise, pray, meditate. I'm like, I need something new. Oh, we got a great guy. So that's how I find sources.
Oh, that's great. So, you know, one of the questions that's come up a lot on your blog post that I wanted to just talk about a bit before we talk about time management stuff, which is also important, is this whole idea of clips. You know, how many clips do I need before I can get a gig? You know, what kind of experience do I have to have, and how can I demonstrate that in a query letter?
So you're saying somebody who has no clips, who has nothing.
Yeah, what if I have no clips?
Yep, I love that question. And this is a story I tell when I talk about this in a workshop or at a conference. You know, there's a saying in the law that if the facts are on your side, pound on the facts. If the law's on your side, pound on the law. And if neither's on your side, pound on the table. Okay? So I want people to pound on the table with their query, meaning you write the best query you can. You have a compelling lead. You show in the second paragraph, this is, you know, more detail and why readers will care about this particular story. In the third paragraph, how you're going to approach the story. Maybe you have a working title, the types of people you plan to interview, how long is the piece going to be, are you going to have a sidebar, you know, here's the angle I plan to approach. You know, it's always like, here's what I'm thinking. And then in the last paragraph, what I call the I am so great paragraph. So one of my first sales was on, let me give an example here. Oh, 10 reasons to date a shy guy, okay? It was like for a trashy women's magazine. But I'm an extrovert, and I had always dated and actually been married to an extrovert at one point. And then when I fell in love with a complete introvert, I was like, you know what? These shy guys, man, if more women knew about these shy guys, there'd be a lot more happy women. And I started listing reasons. And so I came up with this pitch that was like, you know, too often the guy who catches your eye is, you know, the one who's making you laugh at a bar or the one who's the life of the party. Well, you know what? The shy guy is actually the one you want to be with. And then my I am so great paragraph, I said something like, I'm an extrovert who found and married my shy guy, and I couldn't be happier. So that little thing, let's say I didn't have any other clips, but the tone of my query, you know, how well I've written it, how well I've made the case for the story, how well I've shown this is how I want to approach it, that could sell that idea with no clips whatsoever. And so you really want to write the best query possible, because we all start with nothing. And so a compelling query, it really is the most important piece you write as a freelancer, because it's what sales letter, it's your writing sample, it's how you get your foot in the door, it's your first impression. I mean, I can't overstate its importance. And I will tell you, honestly, when I look at the queries that I wrote like early on in my freelance career, they suck. I mean, and some of them sold, but they were bad. I mean, I wrote queries like, I am a freelance writer interested in writing for your magazine. I enjoy reading, you know, name of magazine. Here is my idea. And then there's some stilted, awful, super general query. It's not specific. It shows no background research. It's boring. It's awful. And yet some of those actually sold because they did have some kind of strength to them. But now my point is, if you write a really awful query and you despair, keep writing them, because the more you write, it's a skill. And like any other skill, the more you practice it, the better you become. So now I can write a query and, I'm not kidding, 15 minutes.
Wow.
But I've written hundreds and hundreds of them, and I've critiqued and edited hundreds more. So you give me an idea, I can write a query letter for it. Now I might have to go back and do some background research to flesh it out. But once you know, okay, a lead, okay, why your readers care, here's how I'll approach it, here's why I'm the perfect person, you just start to see everything in query letters.
That's great. And I love the idea that you can quantify it into a 15-minute period. But for those of us who can't do it in 15 minutes, you know, we're more of like the hour and a half query letter, how can we make the most of our time as a freelance writer? And especially thinking of those of us who also want to keep working on our novels or our nonfiction books or whatever, how do we make this all work together so that we're not, you know, up till 3 in the morning trying to get our stuff done?
Well, I'm a big believer in several things. One of them is the night before, or the day before, or whatever, meaning that when I knock off for the day, and I work a very abbreviated schedule now that I have two little kids, but the last thing I do before I knock off work, and that might be like after my kids are in bed, when I'm looking at my email, I'm thinking about the next day, is I think about, okay, what am I going to do tomorrow? What is my most important thing? What is the thing I most don't want to do, which I'll talk about in a minute? But I have some kind of plan for the next day. Now, that doesn't mean that that plan is going to go through perfectly. Again, I have small kids and that, you know, nothing goes the way it's originally planned, it seems like. But I have thought about it in advance. I just taught a seniors class at the Y this morning. Excuse me. I didn't just show up and teach it. I shadowed the class a couple times. I wrote out, I have my choreography written on my arm because I'd never taught this class before. But, I mean, I had thought about it in advance, so when I finally got there to do it, I was sort of mentally prepared. Same thing goes, you're thinking about it the night before, your subconscious can kind of get to work for you. I really think that's true. And you know, if you're working on a novel or a book, thinking about it all the time, you'll have, you know, it's sort of always there. Next thing is, whatever you don't want to do, do it first. And I call that the eliminate the ugliest rule, meaning if it's write the draft of an article you've been putting off, or, you know, talk to an editor about an assignment that isn't going your way, or follow up on an invoice, because otherwise what happens, no matter how much time you have to work, allotted to work, you will come up with ways to put that thing off. And you'll be, oh, I'll do it in 10 minutes, or I'll do it after, I'll get another cup of coffee, I'll do it. You know, first of all, it doesn't get done, you know. And second of all, you spend most of your day or a good part of your day coming up with increasingly creative excuses why you can't do whatever the dreaded task is. Just do it. Do the worst thing of your day first, and then you've got it out of the way, and you start your day off with the worst thing, which I really think that's the best way to start your day. If you hate to exercise, exercise first thing. You're done. Check it off. Now you can move on. So that helps tremendously. The third thing is when you're, let's say, you're going to write an article. Let's say you've got an assignment. It's a 1,500-word article, and you immediately freak out because you've never written that long before. Make a list. Okay, what do I need to do? Well, I need to do some background research. Okay, then I need to identify three sources. Then I need to contact those three sources and line up the interviews. Then I need to conduct the interviews. Then I need to transcribe the interviews. Then I need to write my draft, and that draft needs to be done by a week from Wednesday. So I'll make a specific list, and then I'll mentally think, okay, this story needs to be done by Friday. Then I need to have my interviews done by, say, Tuesday, which means I need to be contacting my experts by Wednesday or Thursday the week before. You don't just show up and write the article. You got to get all those little steps done. So giving yourself mini deadlines, it's not necessarily a time management trick, but it will help you meet your deadlines. And as time goes on, could I do all my interviews in one day and then write the piece the next day? Yeah, but I don't like to do that. I like to have my interviews done and have some breathing room before I go to write the piece. I think another thing is, the more interviews you do, the faster you can do them. I have a friend of mine, when she started freelancing, she's like, well, I really like it, but how do you get off the phone? I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I get on the phone and we talk for like 45 minutes or an hour. She would just talk to her, like go on and on. I'm like, dude, you got to just get your interview done and say thanks. Move on. She's like, but there's a quick thing. I'm like, yeah, well, So when I go into an interview, let's say I'm writing about the health benefits of fiber and I'm talking to a dietitian, I'm going to ask her name, her address, because I'm going to send her a thank you note, her email and phone number, just so that I have all that in my transcript. Does she have a book? How does she want me to identify her in the story? So here's what I'm going to ask you. You know, tell me what fiber is. How does it work in the body? Just explain the difference between the two types of fiber. Why do we need it? Is there such a thing as too much fiber? What are some foods that are high in fiber? Anything else you want to add? That should take me 15 minutes or less to get all that information out of her. Now, she starts saying, you know, well, the interesting thing about fiber is that our ancestors, blah, blah, blah. I'll let her go for a minute, and I'm like, okay, that's interesting, but I need to get back to what I need for this story. So my point, again, it's kind of like a query letter. The more interviews you do, the more you're able to do them more quickly, the more queries you write. Same thing with writing articles. But I think planning ahead, getting your worst thing done first, you know, breaking things up into, you know, making a list, here's the chunk I need to do, here's the chunk I need to do. And then also, very importantly, being aware of what your own body rhythms are. If I have a couple hours in the morning, I can get more done then than I can the rest of the day. I am a morning person. Now, I will work at night if I have to, but I'm not productive at night. I'm really not productive in the afternoon. So I save my mornings for my hardcore writing, and then afternoons might be interviewing, transcribing, researching, screwing around. I mean, that's what I do in the afternoon. So I think it's really recognizing when you are most productive. And if you tell me, well, I'm a morning person too, and you answer your phone all the time, I'm going to tell you, let it go. You know, shut down your email. Use, if you've only got an hour to write, use it to write. Don't go on Facebook because, you know, you're doing research or, you know, or give yourself, set a timer, give yourself 10 minutes to research whatever on Wikipedia and then get off the web. Because I can go on, I could read Wikipedia all day. It's fascinating. And then you jump to the, oh, that, I didn't know that either. But you need to control how much time you're going to spend doing each task. If that helps.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. I'm going to open it up for questions from our callers. I'm going to unmute everybody. So if you need to stay muted because you're having a wild party at your house, go ahead and push star 6 again in a minute. But I want to unmute it in case you want to ask questions. I'm sure that people have lots of questions for you, Kelly. So go ahead. Whoever would like to ask a question, you've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay. You mentioned that.
Go ahead.
Hello, you mentioned Kelly mentioned that online needs more print. Can you give an example of how many words?
Let me explain what I meant. When I say online needs more than print, what I mean is typically they're going to need more articles than a print mag because they're going to be uploading more content. And again, if you look at a website, and again, I'm talking about publications that have a print and an online component.
Right.
So anybody who's got noise going on and you don't ask a question, go ahead and push star 6 and mute yourself. If you have a question, this would be a great time to ask.
I was wondering about the query letter. Do you query and include your article, or you wait for them to get back to you? And secondly, do you query multiple publications with one query letter and just send the article to whoever responds, or how do you handle that?
Okay, that's a great question. First of all, let me just clarify. I would always query first. Querying with the article would make no sense because if the query letter, remember, I want to get her attention, show her why her readers will care, show her how I plan to approach the story, and then have her say yes or no. And I do believe in querying. Second, not writing the article and sending it in, because that article wasn't requested by my editor, and it doesn't give her what my editor is going to want. I mean, I would just be guessing and praying, basically. Second question, yes, I do pitch the same idea to more than one market at a time. However, I don't pitch competing markets. So, for example, I wouldn't pitch the same idea to parenting and parents, but I might pitch the same idea to parents and health, you know, because they're not competing magazines. And I write about the same stuff over and over. So I might, let's say, we'll go back to stress management. I could write about how to help your kids manage stress for parents, and I could pitch how exercise helps you manage stress to fitness, and I could pitch how yoga helps you manage stress to AARP. And if all three of those markets said yes, I would be fine because I'm not writing for nobody's going to get upset that I'm writing about something similar for one of their competitors. So my rule of thumb is not to pitch the same competing markets at the same time. Now, I will tell you, I know writers who do it, and they'll pitch similar markets with the attitude of being, hey, whoever, you know, wants it first gets it. And I could see that that could work too. I'm just telling you, this is my personal rule of thumb because I don't want to annoy an editor or have somebody be upset when I can't. I'm actually writing it for your biggest competitor right now. But that's my personal choice.
And now,
will they respond to you, or how long do you wait when you get no response on the query to go to a competitor?
That's a great, great question. And one thing that we didn't talk about was that when I send a query, if I don't get a response within, let's say, anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks, sometimes they'll say in their guidelines, you know, when they respond, I send a follow-up letter. And, you know, I'm pretty much emailing all of my queries these days, 100% of them. So I just email and I say, you know, dear so-and-so, I'm writing to follow up on my query about women in weightlifting I sent you 6 weeks ago. I've enclosed it, or I've dropped it below. You know, you just forward and then you enclose the, not, I shouldn't say enclose. I forward the email, forward the original query, or I'll just grab the query and then drop it in the same email. Would you let me know if you're interested? If I don't hear from you within 2 weeks, I'll assume you're not interested at this time and may market it elsewhere. So see what I did? If she wants it, great. If not, I'm going to send it somewhere else. And then if I don't hear anything from her, I don't have any problems taking it to other markets.
That's great. Did I understand you right that if you use three different markets, the same article, and they all three wanted it, you could do exactly the same article for all
three? No. It's not the same article. It's a similar idea, but all three of those would be different articles for different markets, depending on what my editor wanted. But I have written that I've written, you know, probably 30 or 40 stories on how to lose weight, and they all come down to, you know, eat less, exercise more. But I could write, depending on what angle I take and who I interview and what research I rely on and how I set the story up, I can write about the same thing over and over. Would I be writing the same article? No. Would I be writing about the same basic idea? Sure.
Thanks.
You know, whose attention do you direct these letters? It seems like it would be very easy and basic to just write, "Dear Editor," but then it would get lost in a massive shuffle.
Do you have a hint on that? Yeah, I do. First of all, if you're pitching a print, always look at the writer's guidelines, okay? Often they'll say who they want you to pitch to. But if I'm pitching, say, a print magazine, I will call the magazine, I'll call Good Housekeeping, and when the person answers, I'll say, "Hi, can you tell me the name of the editor who handles," and then let's say the healthy news section or the features department or the kids news, whatever section you think your article is going to fit in, and that way I have his or her name. I mean, and with online markets, often they will say, you know, so-and-so handles this section, or so, you know, pitch your queries to, and sometimes it is a general email address, you know, editor@self.com. Well, if that's how they want you to pitch, fine. But then in the subject line, I would say, query for your healthy news section. Show something so that it could go to the right person. You can't always find out quickly and easily. Phone call or email, and if I can't find out, then I will use the general, you know, editor@, but I'll always try to say in my query where that query belongs.
That's great. Oh, we have time for about one more question. So does anybody have a final question for Kelly?
I do.
Go ahead. I didn't quite hear the name of the two associations that you can contact experts. CrossNet and Herald, can you spell those, please?
You know what? I will include those in the email to everybody so when I send out the link to the recording, I'll go ahead and include that in the email so we don't have to spend time doing that now.
Thank you.
And anybody who's got some, I think the feedback's from me. So
it is you, yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and put everybody on mute again, and then I'm going to ask Kelly to share her final bit of wisdom. So hold on one second. Hopefully I won't put Kelly on mute.
Okay.
Kelly, I'd love to hear just a final piece of wisdom to share with our listeners.
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, thanks for having me, Rochelle. You know, it's always my pleasure to do this. I honestly think that seeing your byline for the first time, whether it's an article, you know, it's 100 words or 200 words, or it's your first blog post for someone else's blog, not your own, it's really gratifying. Yes, there's money. Yes, you can build a platform. Yes, you can get experience. I already talked about all those things. But it's really gratifying to be published, whether you're published in a print publication, whether you're published online, you've got the link, you can send it to everyone. And I think that as writers, we work by ourselves, our work is mostly, you know, interior work, and it's insular, and we're in our heads all the time. I think it's really important to make that transition from unpublished to published and paid for that reason alone, just because it legitimizes what you're doing in some way, and it makes you, you know, feel more like a real writer. Not that you're not a real writer before you get published, but I do think that when you make that jump, it's a really awesome transition, and you get kind of that, hey, I did it. Now I'm published. Now I'm, you know, taking the next step in my career, you know, whether you care about making a living as a freelancer or not. And I think that's a really gratifying thing that we haven't talked about that is probably maybe even the most important reason to consider writing articles for, you know, whatever markets you're thinking about. And, you know, and I hope that everyone on the call is able to do that, because your first byline, there's nothing, I mean, yeah, your first baby, yeah, it's pretty awesome also, but your first byline is really, really cool too.
Oh, perfect. Thank you, Kelly. It's been such a pleasure to have you here.
So, yeah.
Folks, folks, do not hang up. I just want to remind you of a couple of things. First of all, Kelly's brand new book is Dollars and Deadlines, Make Money Writing Articles for Print and Online Markets. If you go to my blog and look at Kelly's post, you can enter to win a copy of her book. And that contest goes through probably Monday at midnight. So go ahead and take a look at that. It's a great article, great tips. Probably about Friday, I'll be sending out a link to the recording as well as a link to some of the resources that Kelly mentioned, along with a link to her blog and her brand new book. So Kelly, thanks for being with us. Everybody, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to seeing your bylines too. Take care and have a great day. Bye-bye.